Okay. It's kind of a, not an emotional day for me, but it is a little bit, you know, like another milestone. How many of these can I have before? Whoever thought? I wrote a little note to Gil, you know, that we're supposed to, you know, with under the thing, and I said, we stood at the Holmes Park shelter back in 69 and said, well, it'd be nice if you could stay 10 years. And he said, yeah, 10 years seems a normal thing. And I said, you know, my mind at 32, that seemed like an eternity or forever or a lifetime. Well, I told Gil, you know what? It was a lifetime. So we've been blessed, no doubt about it. Well, for you old timers, we're in the book of Isaiah for a purpose. One, it's God's word. And we have this somewhat elevated interest in my question about the timing of the new heavens and the earth being for the kingdom, not after the kingdom. So Isaiah should help answer that question, because two of the quiet places where the new heavens and earth occur are in Isaiah 65 and 66. It also occurs in 2 Peter 3:13, and I think they all point to the fact that the change in the earth, the renovation of the earth, the regeneration of the earth, the making all things new of the earth is for the kingdom. It totally makes total sense, logical, that why wouldn't it be there that it would be made new? But, you know, you want to be careful. You might make mistakes because we're human. So Isaiah is the apocalypse, the destruction of the world of the Old Testament book, and Revelation, the apocalypse of the new. So in somewhat, they do go hand in hand. They kind of echo each other. My conclusion is that there is no new world. I'm going to say new world. I think there's some changes at the new world spot and the 1,000 years. But it's not what's revealed in the Old Testament. I don't think the New Testament reveals that at all. Our intention is to investigate the hypothesis of, in our study of Isaiah, a Jewish book, very important point here, a Jewish book with Jewish promises that has a Jewish end. And the way we Gentiles like to read it, it's a Jewish book with Jewish promises with a Gentile end. And that's not right. It has a Jewish end with Gentiles in it. And an interesting point today about the Jews and the Gentiles in our text today in Matthew and Luke. What are we in? Isaiah 9. So our understanding of the New Testament does not deny any facts of the old. We cannot deny the facts of the old. We all agree to that. So our next section of Isaiah's prophecies, we finished with 6, and we've done already one already in 7 and 8. And so that section 7 to 12 is largely historical, of civil wars and later prophecies, which are used as background for 3 messianic prophecies of hope in chapter 7, 8 to 9. And by the way, this historical background continues throughout the entire book. Okay? So chapter 7 and 8 makes less contribution to our narrowly defined investigative purposes, that is to find the cycles of warning, judgment to restoration. This is kind of reviewing, since it's been 4 weeks, 5 weeks actually, between. So Assyria and Israel, these two northern kingdoms, conspire to upset the south, the kingdom of Judah, and install their puppet Jerusalem. Makes no sense why they would do this. Makes no sense. Why would you do this? Well, they, I'm sure, have rationale for it, because they see Assyria threatening, and they figure, well, if they get these us three together and form some kind of amalgamation, we can stand against Assyria, who is the real big threat. Well, so low is the state of Israel that it joins a Gentile nation that is Syria. Syria and Assyria, remember, they're different. Joins Syria, a Gentile nation, to destroy their brother nation, Judah. But they cannot do it. And why not? Well, because God has to preserve Judah. Because where Judah? Well, that's where the Messiah comes from. They have to be there. Remember, we have promises that have to be kept. So we have Syria, the king Rezin. King of Aram is the same as Syria, not Assyria. Then we have Israel of King Pekah, son of Remaliah. That's Israel, north. Not such good kings. Then we have Judah, King Ahaz, and he's the son of Jotham, son of Uzziah. And by the way, we've noted Ahaz is not a good king, even though he is used of the Lord. Now the Syrians, verse 2 of 7, the Syrians are camped at Israel, the northern territory of Ephraim, north of Jerusalem. All right, so here's Ephraim. And Jerusalem, for some reason or other, doesn't show on here, but it's right there. And so when we say that the Syrians are camped in Israel's territory of Ephraim, north of Jerusalem, you see they are really just north of Jerusalem. Shiloh, where the Ark of the Covenant was for many years, is right there. So that's the middle of Ephraim, one of the tribes of Israel. So these people in Judah, the orange, are traumatized by the prospect of war instigated by their brother nation. And we know about civil wars, how deadly they can be. So Isaiah's task, remember, is to deliver a message of hope to the king, Ahaz. So he's supposed to take his son, Shear-Jashub, and meet the king on the spot. Prophet and king meet him on the spot at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to Fuller's Field. I'm just going to mark it off down there by the Pool of Siloam. That's probably where it is. Doesn't matter. So here Isaiah delivers the virgin-born son sign, and the first prophecy is a virgin will conceive. But this was an unexpected event, but not an impossible event that a virgin would conceive, because if she no longer is a virgin, she obviously has seen a man and she's pregnant by a man, so it's not a virgin birth, but she was a virgin when it was said. Therefore, this sign is not for Ahaz, it's a sign for somebody else. Not for Ahaz. The sign is, the first one, of an impossible event will be given the virgin birth of Jesus. Matthew uses this text to claim this sign. Now, Isaiah warns not to ally with Assyria to counter the Rezin Pekin attacks, rather depend on God for defense. Kind of hard to do, you know? You see these guys coming? So Isaiah gives a second sign. And we're going to guess here at the dates here. These dates always drive me nuts because inclusive, exclusive dates. So to make it work out, I decided I know the Bible is true. And if it is the way the Bible says it's going to be, then I don't have to worry about how it works out. I might make a mistake here. But I have some dates here that kind of work, but don't ask me to reconstruct them. All right. So I'll take everybody else's word for it. Isaiah gives a second sign that the new son of a former virgin will act like a clock. Fingers on the clock. By the time the child knows right from wrong, the firebrands, that is these two kings in the north, Syria and Ephraim, which is his resident in Pekah, will be extinguished. They'll be dead. There'll be no more threat. By the time the kid got a virgin here, no possibility of children yet, but when it happens, this virgin will give birth to a son, and that son will not be able to speak or know right from wrong before these guys are dead. Well, that gives you a little bit of time. So Ahaz of Judah rightly refuses the two-state alliance and is attacked. Don't know what the actual date here would be. Probably would be after 734. Nonetheless, Judah loses. Judah, the south, loses. 220,000 soldiers are killed by Rezin and Pekah. Now remember, God says, don't submit to them, and I'll take care of you. And so how do you get taken care of when you get 220,000 killed? Well, there's judgment coming all the time. But ultimately, God will preserve Judah in a small amount. And God always seems to work with remnants, small numbers. So we think, well, how God taking care of Judah? 120,000 are killed. Well, he's going to take care of Judah in a long sense. He's not going to allow it to dissolve itself. So there's judgment within these blessings. And it's always a blessing for those that survive, you know. In the meantime, Ahaz appeals to Assyria for help. I mean, I guess after losing 120,000, you might think you should. But to get Assyrian help, you get this heavy tribute that he has to pay to Tiglath-Pileser III. So Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser III, and others, this is an order here of sequences, they plunder kingdoms all the way down to the Egyptian border and making Edom and Moab pay tribute. Now, all these pretty colors over here are supposed to indicate that. So this is the one we just talked about, the one that follow, and they come clear down to Egypt. I'm not getting into all of this, but these are the Syrian advances. And here sits Jerusalem, basically an island. so much of an island at Hezekiah, it's down to just Jerusalem, because outside of Jerusalem, the Syrians have taken the kingdom. What is the kingdom down there? It's in ruins now. I've never had the opportunity to visit there. But it's outside of Jerusalem, not very far. Shechem? Not Shechem. Forget it. Whatever it is. So what's really left, and this is really down to the short hairs, as Jack Guthrie always would say, all we have left is Jerusalem. But Jerusalem will not fall. That's all God promises. So we have all these Assyrians coming in, and they're taking over the world. Remember, they will be taking over the world, and the Babylonians will judge the Syrians. You know how this goes. Here, I got a better picture of it. So I remembered that. So we have the orange is the Tiglath-Pileser. And see, it comes down to Damascus. And then we have the green, which follows. See the dates here now. And this is actually the fall of the north already. So then they come in here. And there's the Jerusalem sitting by itself and so on and so forth. All right, so I think we got that. So when Tiglath-Pileser dies, next is Shalmaneser, and then we have Shalmaneser, and we have others. I'm just saying they come down to finally the northern kingdom ceases to exist. So the sign given in 734, the sign was completed by 732. The child will not say mama or daddy before the firebrands are snuffed, the kings die, and the nation will not collapse. That is, the southern kingdom will not collapse. So we have these diagrams of where these forces come from. So now, with all this gloom and doom, we go to chapter 9. The message of doom and gloom of Judah, the Lord in his grace holds out hope for a nation, if not the individuals. Now, a key note here in our understanding of the Bible and the promises made to Abraham. We must remember that the promises of deliverance are national and personal only if saving faith lives in the individual. It doesn't make you any difference if you're a Jew and you have no saving faith. Those promises are diddly squat to you. There has to be the saving faith. Yes, most Israelites will die over the centuries without realizing the promises made to them as a nation. They'll die just like Gentiles. Worse off because they've had the light and they rejected it. The person did not join in their national promises by the mixing in of faith. Remember, faith is just this nebulous thing. Faith is in the one supreme God. Not that he exists, but you're going to depend on him for your life. Jews personally do not benefit from national promises because they lack personal faith. You can't be born a Jew and automatically have all the promises given to you. A national promise will not get them salvation or eternal hope. That is the message of all the prophets. In fact, we get to Hebrews, the New Testament, and it says the exact same thing. The book is to the Hebrews, remember? For indeed we, the believing Jews, have had good news preached to us. We call it the gospel. Just as they also, others that have believed the gospel. But the word they heard did not profit them. It bounced off of them. You know that. Unbelievers hear the word. No, not me. No, not me. Not me. Bounces off of them. Because it was not united or compounded or mixed in with their faith in those who had heard. Now, this distinction must be honored for the Bible to make sense of the idea of spiritual children of Abraham. So we sit here as children of Abraham, but we're not Jews. How can that be? Well, we're like faith of Abraham. That's all for Gentiles. That's not how it works for the Jews. The Jews have the promise, and then they have to add the faith. But if they don't add the faith, the first promise dies. So the covenantalists want to remove the blessings of a national promise, in other words, a future salvation of individuals. In the future, some Jews will be saved. We want to do away with that and make it only about personal faith. Gentiles can have faith like Abraham, thus they would want to nullify all national promises. See, if we can have faith like Abraham, there need to be no Jewish promises. That's wrong. The Jewish promises stand regardless of Jewish response. So Romans 4:16 says, for this reason is by faith, in order that it may be in accordance with grace, so that the promise will be guaranteed to all Jewish descendants. not only those who are of the law, in other words, the Jews, but also those who are Gentiles, who are of the faith of Abraham. That's where we fit in, who is the father of us all. So Abraham becomes our spiritual father, but we're not Jews. Jews and Gentile Christian. Oops, that doubled up there. Okay, so national promise remains for the future Jews. The personal participation in the future is conditioned on saving faith. I think we know that, but our friends don't know that. So we have belabored this point because the next section of hope will not apply to any, not one unbelieving Jew. They're going to be in fear, and they're going to die and go to hell unless they have faith in the God, supreme God of Abraham. That is, in believing the unbelieving in Judah. We call them somebody Israel. As I said, the word they heard did not profit them. They got no value out of it because it was not united or compounded with, that's the word there, with faith. So here goes, line one. And we've had gloom and doom, remember? But there will be no more gloom for her. No more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt, but later he shall make it glorious. All right, so here we have Naphtali and Zebulun. See these little tribal areas? They are in somewhat Gentile-influenced areas, and it's the area where Syria will come and occupy, as well as Syria and Assyria both come from the north. They always come from the north there. That's why north is always such a bad place to come from, because they're always, it's usually the enemy. So these are the tribes of Israel, and it says gloom and doom has come upon them because that's where the enemy has been. But now we're told that those areas, there will no longer be any gloom in them. And we have that area, and we also have the area that's called by the way of the sea, which would be, I think, referred to the Via Maris, the routes that connect the Asian with the African continent, and it goes right through Capernaum, one branch of it, goes up to Damascus, to my right, your right, goes up to Damascus, and it goes down left, down along the coast of the Mediterranean, down to Egypt. So this is where light is going to come. It's in this area by the way of the sea. Then we have one more designation, the side of Jordan, other side of Jordan, the Galilee of Gentiles. And I marked that out with my marker. You can see those are we call it the Gentile area. That's where demons are cast into the pigs and the pigs ran to the sea. That's the northern part here, kind of supposedly around in that area. So it was an area of the Gentiles. We come down here, we have Bethshean is the one of the Deca Greek cities, and it's also in Gentile territory. It's now been uncovered and a great place to visit, if ever we could. So the Lord light, the darkness is in these areas, and light is going to come to these areas. So the people who walk in darkness in these areas will see a great light. Those who live in the dark land, the light will shine on them. Remember, we have the typical poetic expression, you say it once, you say it again. You say the same thing with different words. That's nice. So this section turns to the coming messianic promises made to David in 2 Samuel 7, where it started, not started, but where we know about the king coming. Clearly stated, in coming verses, the personage will be developed in some detail, the personage of the Messiah. So our advanced knowledge, we know all this stuff already. Our advanced knowledge, we are struck by this territory. It is where Jesus spent 80% of his ministry. Now, we're kind of in the Gentile territory. It's not Gentile, but there are a lot of Gentiles around. In fact, Solomon gave some of this territory to Tyre in exchange for temple or palace materials from Lebanon. So I don't know where those areas are, but we sort of have a mixed group up here, even though it is Jewish, but the Gentiles are noted here. And this is where Jesus spends his time. And next picture here. I remember standing here looking over this, and I said to myself, we're looking to the northeast, I'm looking at 80% of the ministry area of Jesus. I mean, that number just hit me, 80%. And then my guides later on said, 80% of the ministry, so okay, we think like... Because whenever you think of Jesus' ministry, where is it? It's in Galilee. northern Galilee, on the north shore of Galilee. You know, once in a while, Nebraska and Nazareth, and once in a while over here, the other side of the area, the shores of the Gentiles. And we have Capernaum back in here. So this is where the Via Maris is. Along here, goes up to Damascus. So this is where Jesus, of all places, spent his time. Why didn't he spend it in Jerusalem where the Jews lived? I think it's kind of interesting they chose this place, because one thing, his message would have blown Jerusalem up. And the second thing, the Gentiles are watching this. And the Lord is as interested in the Gentiles as he's in the Jews. Don't get it mixed up. Sometimes God is so interested in Jews, the Gentiles are diddly squat. No, the Gentiles are involved in this promise. And they also, in fact, if you think about it, the Gentiles in the church seem to numerically overwhelm whatever's been in the Jewish. So it's interesting that we don't want to forget about what happened here, but we don't want to at all, at one moment, take away anything God promised the Jews. So some of you were on this group. These are the pretty ones in our group. And I want to show you this next picture. This is that area, Naphtali, and what was the one in the north here? Yeah, Naphtali and the Zebulun's to the south. Okay. You see Naphtali here. And by the way, this is Mount Hermon. You see these clouds over here? That's where Mount Hermon is. So the upper Jordan River would lay along there. Okay, so this in here would be Naphtali. All right. I have nostalgia when I looked at these pictures yesterday. I wanted to bring you a bunch more, but let it go at that. So the ministry of Jesus starts here. I know he's baptized earlier, but when John the Baptist dies or when he's captured, Jesus knows, okay, it's my turn. Because John the Baptist has finished doing the announcements. So Matthew 4:12 says, now when Jesus heard that John had been taken into custody, he withdrew into Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, he came and settled in Capernaum. See, he's changing his missionary station. He's moving to Capernaum, which is by the sea, in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. This was to fulfill what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet. The land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali. We're talking to Matthew. We're talking about the gospel here, talking New Testament, about the Old Testament. He quotes, by the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, Galilee of Gentiles, the people who are sitting in darkness saw a great light, and those who are sitting in the land of the shadow of death upon them, a light dawned. Jesus just moved into their territory. Matthew says a light dawned on them. From that time, Jesus began to preach to say, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So this, we would say, is the official ministry beginning. And the first thing that's called out here is the land of Naphtali and Zebulun. And the areas of Gentiles are being called into our attention. So we are close to Gentile territory. In fact, we have Gentiles in this territory. We have centurions, we have these people that Jesus healed, they're Gentile as well as Jewish. Also think of the Gentile church, the congregation of Jesus, that's what he called it, which he established that he will establish, he mentioned it at Caesarea Philippi, then he goes on to Jerusalem to be crucified, we had that a couple of weeks ago. That was the end of his ministry. So heading for Jerusalem, his ministry concluded there. All right, so the beginning of the ministry, it's this place, and it said the light came upon them. So now, we have further information about the messianic hope. You shall multiply the nation. You shall increase their gladness. They will be glad in your presence as in the gladness of the harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoils. For you shall break the yoke of the burden and the staff on the shoulders, rod of their oppressors at the battle of Midian, that's Gideon. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle of Tumont and cloak rolled in blood will be for burning fuel for fire. Now, my mind right away goes to Ezekiel 39, the Gog and Magog, where they burn weaponry for 7 years. I'm not sure this is a reference to that, so I say this. This prophecy may be a statement of the end of all Israel Gentile enemies. We have seen from the coming of the nation 1948, Israel has won its engagements handily. And the Gog War may just be an example of what happens when the fortunes of God return to Israel, and that may be what's said here in a general sense, without making it specifically Ezekiel. So here we have one of our beloved verses, and that's why I think we love Isaiah, because it has some of these wonderful verses in it, and we'll tolerate the rest of the Isaiah just to get to these verses. But these other parts of the Isaiah sort of get lost to us, the historical part. So here we have now Isaiah prophesying, for a child will be born to us, his son will be given. Now we're talking about children earlier. And the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. And there will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David or over his kingdom, to establish and uphold it, justice and righteousness from then on forevermore. The zeal of the Lord will accomplish this. This is huge, good news. So we have made the case that the first 1,000 years of the eternal kingdom on the regenerated earth will be partly given to the supposedly righteous to demonstrate their righteousness. And I said supposedly righteous. We know they're not. Man has not been righteous until now, but there's always been some excuse, some reason for man to claim victimhood and thus unrighteousness. To ensure that righteousness will be maintained, the Messiah will rule in justice and righteousness as promised in this verse. There is no need for righteous rule in a kingdom that has only righteous members. So this is my point, that unrighteous dwell in the kingdom. Because we are told here that they dwell there, but they cannot perform unrighteous deeds, because the zeal of the Lord will accomplish it. We don't understand how he could do it, but he can do it. Okay, now we have 5 minutes left. But the present is bleak, and we could probably pretty well skip this part. And that what this is, you know, that all these bad things going to happen. Ephraim said, well, the bricks have fallen down, but we're going to rebuild. You know, the arrogance are proud. Therefore, the Lord raises up against some adversaries, reason, and he spurs their enemies on, the Arameans in the east, the Philistines in the west. These are enemies. What does God say? Well, my anger does not turn away, and his hand is still outstretched. I mean, you do all these things to try to recover, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, but the anger of God still is there. And that phrase is continued here, I think, three times. And I'm going to read through all of this. His anger does not turn away. And these are things, bad things that are happening to them. We're going to recover. We'll be okay. No, anger is not turned away from him. That's why I say you kind of skip over these passages for the good ones. So woe to those who enact evil statutes and those who constantly record unjust decisions about Israel and Judah particularly. And it goes on and on and on. It says your anger does not turn away. His hand is still outstretched. God is not assuaged in his anger. So Assyria's fulfilling of God's will. Isaiah describes Assyria's mission and her motives, that God had commissioned Assyria to chasten Israel as a rod of anger and club of his wrath. Because Israel was godless and had angered God with her sin, Assyria would plunder her cities, ruthlessly trample her people. God often uses unlikely instruments to accomplish his purposes in the world. He's using Babylon against Judah, which puzzled Habakkuk. Isaiah was not claiming that Assyria was godly or that the empire even knew that God was using it to do his bidding. We call that useful idiots. His sovereignty, he directed Assyria to be his tool for vengeance. I'm kind of rushing through this. So in that day, the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but will truly rely on the Lord. See, that's a future look. That's a future hope. Verse 21, and the remnant will return. And verse 22, only remnant within them will return. Now see, these are the guys that have saving faith. They will eventually, in the end, win. All those that did not have saving faith, doesn't matter whether Jew or not, they go to hell like Gentiles go, because they're judged on the basis of their works. So we then have the last chapter here. We'll look into this the morning, just a few verses here. We have tall trees at the end of this chapter. Behold, the Lord, the God of hosts, will lop off boughs, branches, with a terrible crash. Those also who are tall in stature will be cut down, and those who are lofty will be abased. Ever watch these guys that cut down trees? I do that. You know, trees, what's that one called? Never mind. You cut these trees down, and these branches, they are huge sometimes, and they fall to the ground, and they would crush a car. So we have these boughs, they fall with crashed. I'm thinking about that picture. And he will cut down the thickets of the forest with an iron axe, and Lebanon will fall by the mighty one. So then, don't forget the imagery of the tree, chapter 11, verse 1. Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse. A branch from his roots will bear fruit. Isaiah 11:2, the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, and the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel, strength, the Spirit of knowledge, and the fear of the Lord. See, that's going to come back, and that's going to be the shoot of Jesse. This is now a reminder that the Messiah will come from David. So we end that here on time, and we'll pick up 11:3. Now we're going to go into an eternal state section here, the kingdom state, and we'll see very familiar terminology that we have seen before about what the kingdom will be like. And that comes after the Messiah is established. That makes total sense.